This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Three of paleontologist Louis Leakey's most renowned protégés were women. Jane Goodall, who studied the chimpanzees of Gombe, Diane Fossey, who died defending the mountain gorillas of Rwanda, and my guest Birute Galdikas, who went to Borneo to study the orangutans. She arrived in Borneo in 1971 with the goal of studying wild orangutans in their natural habitat. But she says she almost immediately became involved in the rescue and rehabilitation of wild-born orangutans who'd been captured by humans to keep as pets or to sell to zoos, circuses, and laboratories. She also worked to save old-growth primary rainforest because she realized that orangutans couldn't survive if their habitat was destroyed. Galdikas still studies orangutans in Borneo. She also spends part of each year teaching at universities in Jakarta, Indonesia, and Burnaby, British Columbia. She's written a new memoir called Reflections of Eden. She told me what makes orangutans particularly difficult to study.
They live in the tropical rainforest canopy. That canopy is in excess of 150 feet, maybe rising to as tall as, or as high as 170 or 180 feet. They're also solitary or semi-solitary in the wild, which means that it's difficult to find them because you're looking for individuals and not, you know, a chattering group of primates. And then third, they're silent. They really don't make very much noise. And so when you follow them, they're up in the canopy, it's just one individual or a female and her offspring, and they're not making much noise. You know, a little bit of wind comes up, a little bit of rain, and you've lost them.
You know, in the years that you've been in Borneo, you've not only been studying wild orangutans, you've also been very involved with the rescue and rehabilitation of captured orangutans. Some of the orangutans that you rescued from captivity, some of the younger ones, became like your surrogate children. I'm thinking of one in particular. His name was Sugito. Am I pronouncing that right?
Uh-huh, pretty good. Sugito. Uh-huh.
Sugito. And so you became like his surrogate mother.
Absolutely.
And, you know, you'd carry him around. He'd cling to you all the time. Tell us a little bit about what it was like to be the surrogate mother of a young orangutan.
Well, it was very different from being the mother of a baby. For one thing, a human mother can put her baby aside for a minute or two. But, you know, orangutans are found up in the top of the tropical rainforest canopy, so an infant orangutan clings for all he or she is worth. And every time you try to take him or her off your body, you're in for, you know, a major battle. You know, defecation, squealing, screaming, biting, because for the orangutan infant, clinging to the mother is literally in the wild a matter of life or death.
So what are some of the things that you couldn't do while you had this infant orangutan clinging to you?
Well, I ended up doing everything I had to do, but a lot of things were made very difficult. So, for instance, you know, taking a bath, taking clothes, you know, putting clothes on or taking clothes off, because in the early days, when Sugito first came to Camp Leakey, when we first brought Sugito to Camp Leakey, he didn't understand that, you know, that pieces of clothing were not part of my body. I mean, he didn't understand that pieces, you know, the clothes were disposable, that you could, you know, take them off. I mean, he would scream whenever I took off, say, my shirt and try to put it back on me. It was like he didn't understand that this was not a part of my body.
What about sanitary problems? Were there sanitary problems?
Oh, there were horrific ones. At that time in Borneo, you know, there were no disposable diapers or diapers, period. And in fact, it never even occurred to me to diaper the wild-born ex-captive orangutan infants. So I would carry them all day long and sleep with them at night, and they would defecate and urinate. And in those days, I didn't have that many changes of clothing. Basically, I had three sets of clothing. And so I was constantly wet. And as a result of that, I was covered with tropical ulcers. And it wasn't until much later that I began to understand that the tropical ulcer problem was due to the fact that I was constantly drenched in orangutan feces and orangutan urine.
Well, how did you fix the problem once you realized what a problem it was?
Well, it wasn't that I fixed the problem. It was the situation changed. I got more clothes. And once I got more clothes, it became possible for me to change clothes after I was, drenched. The orangutans started getting older. And once they became older, they didn't have to spend all their time on my body. You see, in the wild, an infant orangutan spends the first 4 or 5 years of his or her life clinging to the mother. Only in the 5th year of life does the now juvenile orangutan no longer cling to the mother when she travels from tree to tree.
To how long did Sugito cling to you?
Oh, he clung to me for a good 2 years.
Now, the whole point of taking Sugito away from his captor was to rehabilitate him and put him back into the wild. What do you think that transition period was like for him? Do you think that helped get him back into the wild, or was it hard to get him from your campsite back into the forest?
No, actually, orangutan males are very easy to rehabilitate. When they reach a certain age, and that age is about 9 or 10, in the wild, the mother drives them away, and some kind of hormonal thing kicks in, and the wild orangutan male begins to wander. And it doesn't matter how domesticated he is or how much time he's spent in captivity, when he reaches that age, which is about 9 or 10 or 11 years, he just leaves. He just gets up and goes. And it's when this hormonal, when these hormones, these male hormones kick in. And I suspect that those male hormones are, you know, if they're not testosterone, they're probably related to testosterone. And it's a very abrupt kind of shift. And we see it in the wild, and we see it with the ex-captive orangutan males as well.
So what was it like for when those hormones kicked in for Sugito? Did you notice that? Could you tell a difference?
Well, my former husband, Rod, took Sugito when I wasn't there and released him in another place. The hormones were probably just beginning to kick in. Sugito was not yet wandering great distances from camp. I mean, had Rod waited, a few months more, 6 months more, I'm sure Sugito would have begun wandering, because every single other male orangutan has done that.
Did you see Sugito again after he went back to the forest?
Not that I know of. I mean, he was released a considerable distance from Camp Leakey.
Was that intentional, so that he couldn't come back?
Yes, that was intentional on the part of my former husband, Rod.
Were you sorry about the way he handled it?
I would have handled it differently.
What would you have done?
Well, I would have waited until Sugito just went back to the wild on his own, because that, was sure to come. That's just the way that male orangutans are. I mean, it's inevitable.
But your husband thought that the Sugito was a real handful around the camp and it was time to set him free.
Well, my former husband,
husband, yeah. Birute Galdikas is my guest, and she's been studying the orangutans of Borneo since 1971. She's written a new book called Reflections of Eden, My Years with the Orangutans of Borneo. I want to talk with you a little bit about gender. When you went to Borneo, you already read feminist books. I think you thought of yourself as a feminist. What were some of the differences you observed in the behavior of male and female orangutans? And as a feminist yourself, what was your reaction to those differences?
Well, it's kind of funny. When I first went into the field, I genuinely wanted to believe, and almost did believe, that there really were no differences between men and women. And living in a modern city like Los Angeles, going to university, living a life where, the intellect, the expression of intellect was the most important thing, where, competition took place in terms of writing and publishing, doing analysis, doing research, it was possible for me to fool myself that this was indeed the case. Orangutans are extremely sexually dimorphic. As I mentioned, the males are twice the size of females. The males are very different from the females. The males behave differently from the females. The males have different vocalizations from the females. When you are dealing with orangutans, you cannot ignore the fact that males and females, in a sense, live in different universes, that males and females have different priorities. One of the things that I discovered was that my then-husband, Rod, was very different in the field than he had been in an urban setting. The differences that in modern life, modern urban life, really wouldn't make a difference, such as the fact that Rod was simply stronger than me, and that Rod could run faster than me, and that Rod probably could, in a certain kind of way, endure more than me, and that Rod had more mechanical skills than me, became very, very, very apparent when we were isolated in the forest. And I gradually grew to realize, and this may seem like a trite point, but it really isn't when you consider what the feminist philosophy of the 60s was, that men and women really are different.
Are those gender differences that you find among orangutans true of all primates, or does it vary from one group to another?
Oh, it varies very much from one species to the next. You have gibbons, who are territorial and highly monogamous, and their monogamy seems to be hardwired. They do not exhibit sexual dimorphism. The male and the female look very much alike and behave in very similar ways, are the same size, have canines that are about the same size. And sometimes the female will actually be dominant to the male in everyday kinds of situations. So you have gibbons, and some species of gibbon, for instance, the siamang, which is a large gibbon, the male plays a very direct role in parenting.
You and your first husband separated while you were living in Borneo.
Mm-hmm.
Your second husband, and you're still married, is a native of Borneo. He's from
That's traditional culture.
He's a farmer. Since he was from a traditional culture, and since you were reevaluating your views of gender, did your place in the relationship in the second marriage differ a lot from how you saw yourself as a wife in the first marriage?
No, not really. The amazing thing is how traditional Dayak peoples are probably the most egalitarian people on this planet when it comes to male-female relations. I've noticed that the traditional people really do not differentiate very much in terms of males and females, even though many of their roles are in a funny kind of way reserved for men and women, males and females, that they just have a sort of an ease about it that makes it very easy to marry a Dayak. And I have had now a number of volunteers and colleagues, all North American women, and including one Australian who married Dayak men. And I think the reason that they married their husbands probably are very similar to the reasons that I married Pabohab, and that is that it's very easy to be with these men who in no way have any belligerence or any hostility or any kind of negative feelings about women, but just simply accept them.
We only have about a minute left. I'm sorry I've saved so little time for this, but what would you say are your most important research findings?
Well, I think the most important research finding is the fact that orangutan females only give birth once every 7 or 8 years on average. This makes them the most slowly reproducing animals on our planet, certainly most slowly reproducing primates or mammals on this planet.
Why is that important?
It's important because it explains why orangutans are on the verge of extinction. You know, if you kill rabbits, you could basically wipe out most of the population, but once you stop killing them, they just bounce right back because their reproductive rate is so high. But orangutans cannot bounce back. If you kill most of the females, which is what is happening now today in the tropical rainforests of Kalimantan, you have really caused the population to decline. And that declining population will not bounce back. You have decimated the population. Once the population is low, once there are very few breeding females, it will take countless generations for that population to be replenished.
Birute Galdikas, she's written a new memoir called Reflections of Eden, My Years with the Orangutans of Borneo. This is Fresh Air.